This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا حسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. The World Health Organization raises the alarm about the situation of hospitals in northern Gaza amid Israel's relentless strikes, describing their conditions as appalling. Iran says the U.S. and Germany are fully complicit in the Gaza genocide by abetting Israel's crimes through continued transfer of weapons to the regime. Also coming up, the Israeli regime continues its aggression against Syria, targeting more areas in the western part of the country and near the capital, Damascus. The Israeli war machine continues to kill more Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, across the besieged Gaza Strip. One of the latest attacks killed 8 civilians, including a child, when a residential complex was targeted in the center of Gaza City. 5 civilians, including 2 women, were also killed in airstrikes that hit northwest and south of the city. An earlier air raid on the Al-Shadi refugee camp killed 4 civilians and injured at least 15 others. A young girl also died following an airstrike on a family home in Al-Dusayrat refugee camp. Meanwhile, the World Food Program raised the alarm about Israel's use of starvation as a weapon of war, saying 2 million Palestinians face acute hunger across Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, also said 19,000 children have been hospitalized due to severe malnutrition during the past 4 months. The Israeli genocide has claimed the lives of over 45,000 Palestinians so far, leaving 107,000 others injured. Our correspondent in Gaza, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's strikes, especially on the northern part of the blockaded territory.
The situation is still beyond catastrophic for the Palestinian people and the northern part of Gaza Strip, which is still smoldering in light of the ongoing genocidal campaign targeting every corner of the northern section of the besieged enclave. For the past couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes reiterated the attacks against Beit Lahia City, those areas, particularly Beit Lahia City, in addition to Jabalia al-Balad and Jabalia al-Nazla, are still witnessing more cruel attacks of the Israeli artillery. Massive explosions also were heard and boomed in the northern part of Gaza Strip as a result of the Israeli attacks targeting the Palestinian residential buildings. They are still, as you know, detonating and blowing up residential buildings and the squares. Massive destruction actually unfolded after more videos were released documenting the sheer scale of the destruction and devastation inflicted by the Israeli occupation forces, particularly when it comes to the destruction of the residential squares that were completely wiped out of the map as a result of those constant attacks and bombardments. Let me say that we are talking about more than 75 consecutive days, and the Israeli occupation forces are still ongoing without any cessation. Those areas are still decimated by the Israeli occupation forces, having those attacks maintained from air, land, and sea, targeting every part of the northern part of Gaza Strip. And as you know, thousands of the Palestinian people are still trapped in the northern part of Gaza Strip. They are still suffering from the starvation, famine, and the catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still befalling them as a result of the suffocating siege imposed by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinian people there.
The World Health Organization has raised the alarm about the situation of hospitals in northern Gaza amid Israel's unrelenting strikes, describing their conditions as appalling. WHO's chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the comments after a humanitarian team finally reached northern Gaza's only functioning hospitals. Tedros warned that Israel's relentless strikes on hospitals have left them without specialized personnel for surgical and maternal care. He added that the attacks have resulted in further damage to Gaza hospitals and their oxygen and electricity supplies. Calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, WHO's chief urged for the protection of healthcare in the blockaded territory. The agency also announced that efforts to deliver desperately needed supplies have been repeatedly hampered Amid Israel's onslaught on Gaza, according to Palestinian officials, hospitals and healthcare facilities have been among Israel's main targets during the regime's genocidal war on the besieged territory, which started in October last year. Political analyst Said Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to share his views on Israel's unrelenting strikes on civilian infrastructure, including homes, schools, and hospitals. Let's take a listen.
This is the ultimate thing, that a hospital is, of course, you know, in nobody's mind can you say that you would want to deliberately target a hospital. I can't think of any wars where that's done and, you know, being done officially with the government, you know, actually making it clear it's part of their policy. All the health centers have been totally destroyed. They've also, of course, destroyed residential homes across the whole of Gaza. Schools haven't been spared. You know, virtually every humanitarian zone that was allocated by the Israelis was then also bombed, and people were killed in their tents, burned in their tents with phosphorus bombs and all the worst kind of chemical warfare and bunker bombs. They just didn't care. Refugee camps, humanitarian zones, hospitals, all of it was fair game. It still is, and it's still continuing as we speak. What's been exposed is that not only can Israel do genocide, America can do genocide, they also cannot be held accountable, even though the ICC and the ICJ have put out whatever writs they have, whatever cases they have, they've been ignored.
Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian teenager during a violent incursion into the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. According to Palestinian sources, the regime's forces, accompanied by several military vehicles, raided two areas east of Nablus, firing live rounds, toxic tear gas, and sound bombs. The Palestinian youth lost his life after being critically wounded by Israeli forces' live fire, who also prevented medical teams from helping him. The new fatality came after earlier incursions by Israeli forces, during which 16 Palestinians were detained in several towns across the West Bank. The regime's forces also demolished Palestinians' homes in several areas and wounded a Palestinian boy by shooting him in the head in a raid on the Blatter refugee camp. More than 12,000 Palestinians have been detained and at least 800 killed across the occupied West Bank since Israel started its genocidal war on Gaza. Political analyst Firas Al-Naj was earlier with us. He explained why Israel has intensified its aggression across the occupied West Bank and why it continues to get away with it.
Well, because the West Bank people are very in touch and feeling what's happening in Gaza, and they're rising up against this oppression and this genocide and Holocaust happening in Gaza. And they're trying to fight the Israeli occupation. Under international law, the West Bank is part of the Palestinian territories, and as you can see, they keep breaching international law. And the reason why they're getting away with it is because of the international community's weakness and its inactiveness in fighting all these breaches. If they were to punish the Israeli regime, then they would not be able to expand their you know, their occupation and their killings of the Palestinians in this manner. But the reason is because there is no true implementation of the law happening within the Palestinian state and within what's happening with the Zionists. And it's continuing, and they continue to kill people. As we can see now, they kill another youth. Since October 7th in the West Bank and different areas, they have killed as estimated, was 800 different individuals, Palestinians, by the Israeli occupation. As well, thousands have been arrested and put in prison.
Iran has strongly condemned the U.S. and Germany for aiding and abetting Israel's crimes against Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The foreign ministry spokesman said the two countries are fully complicit in Gaza genocide through continued supply of weapons to the regime. Ismail Baghaei said Washington and Berlin are defying all legal norms that are needed to ensure respect for international humanitarian law. He added that the two countries are also violating their international obligations for prevention and punishment of genocide. The spokesman asserted that Germany and the U.S. supply 99% of the weapons exported to Israel and could halt the Gaza genocide overnight if they stop sending arms to the regime. He emphasized that the two countries must be held accountable for their wrongful and criminal acts. In Tehran, a powerful gathering has brought together students and academics to discuss one of the most pressing issues of our time, the ongoing genocide in Gaza. The event titled Student, the World, and Palestine was marked by an impassioned address from South Africa's ambassador to Iran, Francis Molloy. Gisumisha Ahmadi reports.
Highlighting the ongoing struggle of the Palestinian people as the U.S.-Israeli genocide continues in Gaza. Bringing together students and academics in Tehran University, a meeting titled Student, the World, and Palestine gained significant importance as the South African ambassador to Iran also participated. Reaffirming his country's commitment to supporting Palestine's pursuit of justice, he called for the expulsion of the Zionist regime from the United Nations.
What has been happening in Gaza since October last year has been nothing else but an open and shut textbook case of genocide. What Israel has been doing against the people of Palestine is a classic definition of what the genocide is all about. And we as South Africa, as the signatory to the Genocide Convention, took it upon ourselves to approach the International Court of Justice to force Israel to be held to account, because what they are doing there falls within the definition of the crime of genocide.
The ambassador took the opportunity to brief the participants on South Africa's latest actions at the International Court of Justice.
In October this year, we filed our memorial with the ICJ. Now, our memorial is it's about more than 4,000 pages of an indictment where we clearly set out the evidence upon which our case against Israel is based.
This gathering serves as a reminder that the fight for justice is far from over. It is a movement that knows no borders, a global call that demands attention.
The Palestinian struggle for liberation underlines everyone's struggle around the world for liberation. In other words, it is the crystallization of struggle and liberation around the world. It meets there. It starts there in Palestine.
Student movements have always been at the forefront of the struggle against oppression, which is why we have consistently supported Palestine.
We have intensified our efforts within the student movements and are hopeful that by amplifying our voices, we can make a meaningful difference.
The event culminated with the South African ambassador receiving an award on behalf of his country, recognizing their efforts in initiating legal processes aimed at holding Israel accountable. This act underscores a crucial truth: that solidarity is a powerful force in the fight against oppression.
And based on the arguments, the participants say that at the end of the day, it is human solidarity that will save us all. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggression against Syria, targeting more areas in a bid to expand its occupation in the Arab country. The regime's latest attacks targeting areas around the coastal city of Latakia in western Syria. The regime's warplanes also fired several missiles at a military base on the northern suburbs of Homs in central Syria. Fresh Israeli attacks also struck the Saida Zainab district on the southern suburbs of the capital, Damascus. According to Syria sources, Israeli forces have entered the village of Al-Maria in the southwestern countryside of Dara and are trying to take control of four villages in the area. Based on the latest data, Israel has occupied over 370 square kilometers of Syrian land. Israeli media have claimed that the regime's forces are conducting a massive preparation to stay in Syria for a long time, including in Mount Hermon. Yemeni media says the United States has carried out another act of aggression against the country. hitting the capital Sana'a with a fresh airstrike. According to Yemeni sources, U.S. aggression targeted Al-Ardi complex and the capital Sana'a's Safiya district. The U.S. Central Command CENTCOM has assumed responsibility for the attack. It claimed that the strike targeted command and control facility used by Ansar Allah resistance movement for coordinating operations against U.S. Navy warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. The strike came after a high-ranking Ansar Allah member warned the U.S. against escalation of tensions, saying Washington will open the gates of hell on itself by an upsurge in its acts of aggression. Iran also strongly condemned the aggression against Yemen by the U.S. and U.K. as a blatant violation of international law and the United Nations Charter. Now to the UK, where activists have held a conference to highlight the British government's attempts to crack down on pro-Palestinian action. Talks particularly focus on the misuse of counter-terrorism laws and the prosecution of individuals and groups like Palestine Action. Issa Kazemi reports.
As the Israeli genocide against the people of Palestine continues, several groups and individuals have taken direct action against the Israeli war machine in the UK. In August of this year, for example, dozens of activists from Palestine Action stormed the Bristol-based plant belonging to Elbit Systems, the largest weapons manufacturer in Israel, causing an estimated £1 million worth of damage and reportedly resulting in major disruption to some of the most sensitive elements of the factory for months to come. In total, 21 people have since been arrested in relation to the factory raid, many of them under draconian UK anti-terrorism laws, sparking condemnation from human rights groups and observers across the world. As a result, the pro-Palestinian groups have held a meeting under heavy security in the western English city of Bristol to discuss the British government's legal warfare strategy.
Campaigners argue that the British government's use of anti-terrorism legislation is not only intended to punish those disrupting the Israeli war machine, but also to discourage others from taking action against Israeli companies like Elbit Systems and others drenched in Palestinian and Lebanese blood.
Professor David Miller is one of the foremost anti-Zionist academics in the UK. He has been targeted by pro-Israel lobby groups that led to his dismissal from the University of Bristol, an injustice he successfully challenged in court.
They're trying to use any means that they can to attack the pro-Palestine movement. They're using hate crime legislation, and they started to use terrorism legislation. Yes, criminal damage, but they're also using the terrorism legislation against journalists and saying that some journalists have been supporting proscribed organisations, which is plainly ridiculous, but they are using the terrorism legislation, the Terrorism Act of 2000, the Terrorism Act of 2006, in order to suppress the Palestine movement. They can't find any other way of doing it but than using legislation which is plainly inappropriate.
For Professor Miller, the pro-Palestine movement is growing in the UK, and attempts to crush them will not be successful.
It's an intimidation tactic. What they're hoping to do is to convict some people of the Terrorism Act and say, look, this is what awaits you if you take up a placard, a slogan, if you try and invade an arms factory, you will be put into jail. And they want to destroy the pro-Palestine movement. And of course, they're not going to succeed. I mean, the outrage about the genocide is far too deeply entrenched in the UK amongst public opinion. Most young people in this country now believe that Israel has no right to exist. And that's a complete sea change from a year ago.
Britain's culpability in the historic and ongoing crimes of the Israeli regime means that many among the UK public feel duty-bound to continue disrupting and struggling against the Israeli killing machine's tentacles in Britain and beyond. Issa Kazemi, Bristol, UK.
Stay safe and bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
American Association of University Professors say arrests are part of a larger crackdown on pro-Palestinian speech at universities. The arrests come weeks after the FBI raided the home of two Palestinian-American students at George Mason University, who were leaders of the school's Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Monitor wrote, two faculty members at New York University, NYU, were arrested recently during a demonstration on campus where pro-Palestinian supporters were demanding that the university divest from companies profiting from the Israeli regime war on Gaza, according to the university's Faculty for Justice in Palestine chapter. The arrest occurred during a sit-in at NYU, where students were non-violently blocking access to the BOPS library. According to the American Association of University Professors, the professors were not involved in the protest itself, but were there to ensure the safety of the student demonstrators. At the recent protest, the students were calling on the university to divest from Israeli regime companies profiting off of the oppression of and violence against Palestinian people. A total of 8 people were arrested during the protest. Video circulating on social media showed one of the faculty members, sociologist Andrew Ross, being arrested and taken away by New York Police Department officers. Three NYU faculty members, two of whom were arrested during the protest, were made aware that they had been declared persona non grata, PNG, by the school's security. This move makes them unable to enter any university buildings, including their own classrooms. The NYU Faculty for Justice in Palestine said in a statement recently, the faculty were told that the PNG order came from the office of the provost, Gigi Dopico, who later verbally confirmed the PNG status, but said she had no details on the reasons for it, except that it was a security issue. Middle East Eye reached out to NYU for comment, but did not receive a response by the time of the reading of this article. The American Association of University Professors, AAUP, condemned the arrest, saying they were part of a broader crackdown on pro-Palestine activists at universities. This crackdown on NYU faculty is part of a distressing pattern of repression of pro-Palestinian speech on college campuses, Todd Wolfson, president of the AAUP, said in a statement, adding, the AAUP condemns this practice, and we will fight to defend academic freedom and the right of faculty, students, and staff to peacefully assemble on campuses across the country. Since the Zionist regime war on Gaza began in October 2023, university students have been some of the leading proponents of pro-Palestinian actions calling for an end to the war. Earlier this year, student encampments were set up by students across dozens of schools, with their demands being that universities divest financial interest in companies profiting from the war on Gaza. Those protests were met with widespread crackdowns from university administrations working in tandem with police. Legal advisors and student activists have told Middle East Eye that they fear the current campus climate coupled with the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump in January, could lead to even greater reprisals for students and faculty simply engaging in pro-Palestinian or anti-war rhetoric. The arrests come weeks after the FBI raided the home of two Palestinian-American students at George Mason University, who were leaders of the school's Students for Justice in Palestine chapter.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. From Beirut.
Welcome to today's episode, broadcasting from the heart of Beirut, and I'm your host, Farah Atwi. The Israeli government's recent decision to advance settlement expansion in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights has sparked widespread condemnation across the region and beyond. But yet, nothing stopped it from moving forward. Announced on Sunday, the plan cites the war and the new front facing Syria as key factors, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu emphasizing that strengthening the Golan is strengthening the state of Israel. In response, several Middle Eastern countries, including Yemen, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Iraq, have condemned Israeli's actions. The expansion has also broader regional implications, particularly for Lebanon, as Israeli forces are now reportedly just 15 kilometers from the Damascus-Beirut International Highway, raising major concerns over the security dynamics in the region. I'm joined by Mr. Ali Rizik, a political and security analyst. Hello and welcome to this episode, Mr. Ali. As we highlighted, the Israeli government announced, and this is the latest announcement, that it wants to advance settlement expansion in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. What is allowing Israel to move in this very fast pace, though a lot of criticism are coming towards it, but nothing is stopping it from expanding the settlements, from expanding the invasion, from taking over territories that is not theirs?
Obviously, Israel took advantage of the latest developments in Syria. We saw since day one of the departure of former President Bashar al-Assad, we saw the escalation. Even before that, by the way, the Israelis were escalating against Syria. So they're taking advantage to the maximum of these events. We know that the current Israeli government is an ideological fascist government which has its own expansionist agenda. So it's not very surprising, I believe, to see this activity taking place. Syria now is a weak state. Indeed, you could call it possibly a failed state. And that allows the Israelis, I think, to do as they wish when it comes to their expansionist agenda.
For the greater Israel?
It's part of it, of course, the greater Israel. Netanyahu, before the late, or during, actually, the latest developments, before the start of the war on Syria, but it was during the escalation on Lebanon when he spoke about a greater Middle East.
Yes.
And so I think this is all part of it, part of the broader Israeli agenda now. It doesn't necessarily serve Israeli interests. I think that's a different question. It might serve Netanyahu's ambitions by right now, but it doesn't necessarily serve Israeli interests, because Syria under a new leadership might be not allied with Iran like we saw before. And I think that if there were to emerge a Syrian country not under the leadership of Assad, but under the leadership of another party which is pro-Israeli, that I think would be more to Israel's benefit than having a weak state like you have now. So it's not necessarily the case that the Israelis are behaving in a way which serves their own interests. Mm-hmm.
But the impression that we're actually receiving, as if Syria is the central point for the ambition of creating or changing the face of the Middle East, as if it's very vital strategically, geographically, Israel is putting so much attention in there. Do you believe that that's the central point or the central power that will allow Israel to create or to change the face of the Middle East, starting from that strategic point?
Well, obviously, look, there's no denying the fact that Syria is a very important part of the axis of resistance. It's known as the linchpin of the axis of resistance. It connects Iran to Lebanon, Hezbollah. We all know that Hezbollah is Iran's number one strategic ally and Iran's number one ideological ally. Mm-hmm. So I think you can understand, based upon that, why the Israelis are giving so much importance to taking control, to seizing more and more territory. But I think, again, some of the behavior we're seeing is not necessarily strategic. Some of it is more ideological driven.
Yes.
And I think that doesn't bode very well for Israeli strategic considerations.
Okay. The Golan Heights is a Syrian territory, and it was occupied by Israel in 1967, along with the West Bank, including Jerusalem and the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. The international community, and obviously an international law, consider it to be an occupied territory, but yet Israel continues to move forward and neglecting all kind of condemnation. Of course, here I wanted to ask, do you think that because at one point the Israelis feel that the armed opposition led by al-Julani, by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, they sense this kind of weakness since day one, and that's why they had had the impression of a green light to invade and to go inside Syria.
In fact, if you look at the history of these groups, whether it be Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or al-Nusra or even al-Qaeda or ISIS, what we call these Salafi jihadi groups, Israel is not on the top of the list of their enemies. If you go back to 2016, the director of the Mossad...
But it is an enemy to them, but not on the top of the list.
I don't think it's even considered an enemy, in my humble opinion.
Yes.
There were some documents found in the hideout of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad in Pakistan, which revealed that he had some animosity towards the Israelis, but that's never been put into actual practice. Now, if you go back to 2016, the director of the Mossad at the time, he was asked about the Israelis providing medical treatment to al-Nusra fighters back then. And when he was justifying this medical treatment Israel provided, he said that al-Qaeda never had targeted, or Israel was never a target for al-Qaeda.
Yes.
So based upon that history, I think that the Israelis have good reason to assume that even if HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is going to come to power, has risen, this isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yes.
In fact, those powers or those players that have been pushing the United States to remove HTS from their terrorist list,
yes,
these are Israeli voices. For example, Washington Institute for Near East Policy is a pro-Israeli think tank. Mm-hmm. It's been pushing a lot. And that's what I think, that's what serves the Israeli interest. The Israelis always try to steer the American policy in their direction, and often they do succeed.
Yes.
So I think that's basically the way the Israelis see the situation. They see that Al-Qaeda, Salafi jihadis, they're a much more preferable option, mm-hmm, than having a player or a party which is closely allied with Iran and Hezbollah.
Okay, so you spoke about the priority and the way that they see what to prioritize when they want to, who is their enemy is. However, now Al-Junani, Mr. Ali, is presenting himself as the moderate, calm personality, and he was always like allowing others to feel comfortable when he is around, or as in giving like statements that comes especially the minorities inside Syria, and as if he's presenting a new ideology and a new concept that does not go along with ISIS or with Al-Qaeda. Okay, does he still believe what you're highlighting, as long as he is giving the impression that he's dissected from that region?
He might be sincere in making these statements. I don't know. He might be sincere saying that he wants to modernize, or he wants to make HTS more moderate. But I think there's an important thing to remember. There are cases where you have groups that are fighting a local cause, and they adopt the name of ISIS and Al-Qaeda as a way to elevate their status, and that gives these groups a foothold as well.
Okay.
This happened in Africa.
Yes.
HTS is not one of those cases. HTS never started off as a local Syrian group. Julani was sent by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi to Syria, mm-hmm. specifically with the task of establishing Al-Qaeda. So he was never a local Syrian group. So even if he makes these statements, there's a deep ideological root, if you would like, and it makes it quite difficult for them to shake off. It might be the case, therefore, that while Al-Julani could be sincere, there are some hardline elements within HTS who don't agree with his agenda. So that opens the question to various possibilities.
Exactly.
Will others
exactly.
topple him?
Yes.
Will those more hardline elements migrate to ISIS, and that would serve ISIS and strengthen ISIS?
Yes.
So you don't have to necessarily take his statements of being a source of reassurance.
Okay. We will speak more about that point, because it's very important, actually. However, here the goal, according to the latest news coming in, the goal is to double the Israeli population in the region. And that's exactly what they highlighted. However, in the previous comments coming in, they said, or did they describe the invasion as a temporary invasion? What's the contradiction here?
No, I think that these remarks about temporary, I think these are all shouldn't be taken at face value.
Yes.
I think this is all an excuse. Even when they speak about trying to prevent the jihadists from seizing weapons, they use this as a pretext.
Yes.
As I said, Al-Qaeda and these groups, they never posed a threat to Israel to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a false excuse to use by the Israeli side. I think the Israelis, again, they are seizing. They believe they have an opportunity at hand to further expand their agenda. But again, I don't think this necessarily is a good strategy. I think what would have been better for the Israelis was to have a Syrian government, which is against Iran, against
yes.
Hezbollah, a central government, instead of having a weak state.
Okay, for sure here, Al-Sha'ar highlighted that he doesn't want to be engaged in any battle. But at the same time, Mr. Ali, he condemned these actions by the Israelis. He did not...
But he did condemn, but he also said we have no fight.
Yes, no will to fight.
No will to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also important to remember when he addressed the issue of Iran, he said we have no problem with the Iranian people.
People, not the government.
He didn't say
yes.
the government.
Yes.
That gives you an idea
He's picking up the words very carefully here.
That gives you an idea, I think, of where his agenda lies. When he says we don't have the will to fight Israel and we don't have a problem with the Iranian people, that gives you an idea, I think, that there's still an animosity and hostility towards Iran. That's what I would presume.
That's how you see it, or you see it as someone who's not, the agenda is not clear yet and waiting for the response of international community and international countries before replacing or before submitting the foreign agenda.
No, actually, I think it's quite likely that his agenda is to be
anti. He's been quiet for a while, 7 days without expressing how the opposition feels towards Iran or towards Palestine or towards Hezbollah.
Look,
at one point you can have the impression as a commentator as if he was waiting for the response of these countries. What would their motion be like, especially about Russia, before presenting the vision of the opposition towards Iran specifically?
Again, in my humble opinion, I think it's quite likely that he still holds the hostility
yes.
towards Iran. Based on his record, based on his statements,
don't see any diplomatic talks.
Look, it's possible. There's one factor I think we have to remember. Turkey, People say that Turkey has an influence over HTS. And Turkey is always careful when it comes to ties with Iran. Both sides, despite their differences, they always try to calm and to limit these differences as much as possible. If Turkey does have that influence over Julani, you might see Julani or Ahmad al-Sharr take a somewhat different approach, a more lenient approach. But HTS isn't under the complete control. It's not the SNA, the Syrian National Army.
Yes.
The Syrian National Army is Turkey's main ally. HTS is a bit different. So I'd be hesitant in making the conclusion that they're going to try and build good ties
with
Iran. It's a possibility, but I don't think it's a very likely one.
Okay. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stated, as I highlighted, strengthening the Golan is strengthening the state of Israel, and it's especially important at this time. We will continue to hold on to it because it to blossom and settle in. And here again, how important is the Golan Heights to the Israelis, in your opinion?
It's always been a very strategic, important strategic location. It's a vital location.
Because it oversees the certain borders, right?
Yeah, indeed. Militarily, yes. Strategically, yes. It's of the utmost importance.
Despite the expansion and despite the will of it for expansion.
Not just that. I think if you remember, during Trump's first term, that's why there was an insistence from the Israelis that Trump recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Syrian-occupied Golan Heights. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the first thing the Israelis did after the events in Syria was to take more control of the Golan Heights, that gives you an idea of how strategic they view this location or this position to be. Mm-hmm. So again, they're seizing the opportunity. They see that this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance, and they're seizing it to the maximum.
Okay. Israeli government here approved this plan to encourage demographic growth in the occupied Golan Heights by allocating more than $11 million, and that definitely explains how important this area is due to this huge amount. With all these violations, but yet you hear Netanyahu saying we have no interest in conflict with Syria, and this is a very important factor. Israeli actions in Syria were intended to thwart the potential threats from Syria and to prevent the takeover of terrorist elements near our border. And again, Al-Julani, head of the HTS, clarifies that we are not interested in any battle nowadays. And Netanyahu said that we do not want war with Syria. But yet, the invasion continues. 80% or 85% of Syria's military capabilities have been demolished. We have seen also new villages being occupied by Israel. The opposition is very weak towards that. But then two sides say that we do not want to battle. But a battle is occurring on the ground.
I think Netanyahu is making Ahmad al-Sharr look very bad, by the way.
How?
Because Ahmad al-Sharr, as someone who is, he spoke, for example, highly about Hamas, about Hamas's operation. He saluted that operation.
Yes.
He expressed his support. His name, look at the name of his organization, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Liberating Damascus.
Yes.
Now, liberating Damascus or al-Sham from who? You want to liberate Damascus only from the former government, or do you want to liberate it from other powers? So by Israel, by doing that, it is making Julani look, rather weak. And that does not bode well. I think that Netanyahu...
And do you think that we had that impression, that he was succeeding in allowing people to have that image towards al-Julani? Because he stayed silent for 7 days even before declaring any position towards the Israeli invasion. Did he succeed, Benjamin Netanyahu, in that?
In making Julani look weak? I think he succeeded in making him look hypocritical and also maybe a stooge of the Israelis.
Yes.
So... If Netanyahu, I think, was smarter or wiser, I think what would have been a better path for Israel, I'm glad he didn't take it,
okay. But
what would have been better was to have a strong ally, anti-Hezbollah and anti-Iran in Syria, rather than pursue the policy he's doing now, which is to weaken al-Julani and weaken others and proceed with an expansionist Israeli agenda.
Yes.
So again, it's not necessarily the case that Netanyahu always behaves in a way which serves the Israeli interests. I think that there are other factors at play. There's an expansionist agenda at play. Let's wait and see. One important development to keep an eye on is how President-elect Trump is going to deal with this situation. If you recall,
and that explains why Israel is rushing towards these expansions.
Israel and
because Trump clarified that we do not have any interest in Syria and we don't want to get involved inside Syria.
Indeed.
Do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu is afraid that he will halt these aggressions or these actions, and that's why he wants to finish quickly with the Biden administration still in office.
I'm not sure about that. No, I think that Netanyahu was basically seizing on the momentum and the intersection, if you would like, of interests with Turkey. Mm-hmm. Because you have to remember, Turkey is also a very important player in everything. Turkey has had its agenda. Netanyahu had his own agenda. I wouldn't say Turkey, Erdogan, I think. So their interests intersected, and this played out in the scenario which we witnessed. So,
At one point also, there are lots of things that will separate them, the Turkeys and the Israelis, because the Israelis, at the beginning of this dilemma, they actually clarify that they are ready to assist the Kurds and to assist the Druze inside Syria. However, Turkey is launching a great fight through the Syrian National Army and against the Syrian Democratic Force. We are seeing this contradiction here. Where do they come across, and where do they separate?
I think
the next stage, according to analysts, Mr. Ali, is that a war can occur between Turkey and Israel.
It wouldn't occur by the you mean Turkey and Israel like conventional militaries?
Yes.
That's a very, very far-fetched scenario. Mm-hmm. I don't think that would happen. Turkey is a NATO ally. It's a member of NATO. It's still an American ally.
Yes.
Israel is an American ally.
And Israel is supporting the Kurds.
Israel is supporting the
and
Kurds.
And the United States is supporting the Kurds.
That might change when Trump comes to power. If you remember, in his first term, he said that after a phone call with Erdogan, he said, I'm going to withdraw. And basically he was going to leave the Kurds to suffer their own fate. So that might, and I think that explains why the Turks were so much in a hurry to proceed with this operation, because when Trump comes to power, mm-hmm. Trump could possibly agree with Erdogan regarding having Syria under Turkish influence.
Okay, and here there's a very important, actually, a point to continue what you're highlighting. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham said that, of course, they want to destroy our friends in Israel. There are 50,000 ISIS fighters under the control of Kurdish allies of the United States in northeastern Syria. That's exactly what he said when he was asked about what are they scared of, and then he explained that the extremism to be involved inside, extremists to be involved in the opposition. But he highlighted a very important point, speaking about 50,000 ISIS fighters under the control of Kurdish allies. So it's basically a very important and strategic point here that we're highlighting. We're speaking about an outbreak that can occur if these extremists reach to power.
Whenever we look at the statements of Lindsey Graham, we have to remember that you're talking about one of the most pro-Israeli congressmen in the United States. Lindsey Graham is a perfect example of those who place Israeli interests even above American interests.
Obviously.
So, these statements are related. Of course, Israel does not want the U.S. to withdraw. Whether it be from Syria.
Because there is a risk of an outbreak also, because these 50,000, they are under the Kurdish.
But I don't think it's really about ISIS. For Lindsey Graham in particular, it's not about ISIS. It's about the Israeli agenda. The Israelis want the Americans to remain in this region because they consider this to support them against.
So they use it as a pretext? Because the Israelis also use the extremism.
Lindsey Graham.
Seeking into the borders.
Lindsey Graham and these figures, they do use it as a pretext. Robert Ford, by the way, who used to be the U.S. ambassador to Syria, he said that the reason behind the U.S. presence in Syria is Iran. Mm-hmm. It's not ISIS.
Okay.
So many American figures do use it as a pretext. Now, when it comes to Trump personally, I think we have to differentiate. Trump made a statement in the campaign in 2016, the campaign trail. He said, mm-hmm. and I quote, I don't like Assad, but Assad is fighting ISIS, Iran is fighting ISIS, and Russia is fighting ISIS.
Okay.
Meaning that in Trump's own perspective, he deems ISIS to be the greater threat, the Salafi jihadis to be a greater threat. Agree to what was proposed.
Okay. Speaking of the recent developments in Syria, and to end this with this, Sheikh Qasem emphasized that Hezbollah, and I was trying to highlight and go in depth with that, supported Syria due to its anti-Israeli occupation stance, contributing to the resistance capabilities through its territory for Lebanon and Palestine. However, and he highlighted, with the fall of the old regime and the rise of new forces, we cannot assess these new powers until stability is achieved and their positions are clarified. So again, even Hezbollah is waiting to actually see how this opposition, armed opposition inside Syria, will function in order to decide how it will be dealt with.
Of course.
So nothing to rush about blocking the way through a diplomatic ties. As if all sides are anticipating and are waiting to see how others will act in order to decide the politics towards it.
Of course. I mean, Hezbollah, whether it be Hezbollah or any other player,
yes.
That's the wise or that's the diplomatic, pragmatic approach to take. Mm-hmm. But it's important that he emphasize the Israeli perspective and the support for Palestine, mm-hmm. because Hezbollah's intervention or role in Syria before, it was often described as being sectarian, being anti-Sunni, if you remember.
Yes.
So the fact that he emphasized the anti-Israeli perspective, I think that was also a response and an attempt to say very clearly that Hezbollah has no problem with whoever is in power or whichever religious sect or confession is in power.
Yes.
What concerns us is the stance towards Israel, which is our major enemy. So I think that's important to bear in mind when we look at Sheikh Naim Qasim's remarks. And it's only natural for him to say, let's wait and see how these new people, how they approach the situation. Again, I might be mistaken, but I'm not optimistic that Julani or Ahmad al-Shara or HTS are going to be friends of the acts of resistance.
Okay. Regarding Hezbollah's military supply route through Syria, Sheikh Qasim acknowledged the loss of this route, but stressed that the resistance is adaptable, capable of finding a new path or relying on alternative methods if needed. And that's exactly the answer that to all questions that many here in Lebanon were asking since day one. Now we lost the route to Syria. What will happen to Hezbollah? Will they be weakened? Where would they get their supplies from? So Sheikh Naim Qasim came to actually say that in order to calm the situation down. Do you think that the resistance is still as powerful as we know?
Well, look, I wouldn't say that it's as powerful.
With all taken into consideration all what's happening in the region, Israel being very close to the borders, of course, here the ceasefire is described as fragile, development inside Syria, Gaza, overall, how do you see it?
Look, I think the best way to put it is Hezbollah is down but not out. And the fact that it's not out in of
Even
itself.
Even Sheikh Naim Qasim said that.
The fact that it's not out, that in of itself is an achievement, I think.
Yes.
After what happened to Hezbollah with the pages, with the assassination of the senior commanders. So Hezbollah, you know, it remains a formidable force. It does have some time. I think it needs some time to rebuild and to adjust. And even Sheikh Naim Qasim alluded to these issues. But it's still there. And I think that regarding your point about Syria, that they lost this supply route, resistance or what they call guerrilla movements, they always have their methods, I think, of getting weapons, of being able to make up. So I'm sure that Hezbollah will find a way to make up to some degree for the loss which it suffered in Syria.
Okay. Ali Rizek, political and security analyst. Thank you very much for joining us today. It was very nice talking to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our time is up. We'll be here with more political updates. Stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of your program, The Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. This is Said Ali, the host, and I am privileged to have two of my dear brothers here in this studio. Dear Sayyid Zain, assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Good to have you here. And dear brother Muhammad, assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Really good to have you here. So today we're going to talk about liberalism for sure. And we all know that liberalism has been a great impact on our society in the last, at least I would say, century. And you can see the impact and the effect of liberalism on, you know, sexuality, family, reproductive rights, whatever you can name it here. But we're going to focus mainly on these three topic. So I'm going to start the conversation with dear brother Sayed. Sayed, liberalism, how can we define it?
So the definition of liberalism in a general sense in the Western context would be this, that it's the idea that there are no bounds, that the human being himself or herself decides his or her own destiny. Mm. There is no authority that is prevails over the human being. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's the human being who basically decides what he or she wants to do. And whatever he or she believes is good for, you know, them, they have the right to do this. And this is a fundamental right, and that this is the right that prevails over all other rights.
So sexual liberalism is growing in many societies as we speak. And how do the supporters of sexual liberalism justify their perspective? I mean, aren't they aware of the fact or the impact of sexual liberalism on the unit of family, these natural, you know, units right. in societies?
So one thing that I would try to add, and inshallah support what you were saying, is the idea of why do these societies need a family in the first place? Mm-hmm. You know, because somebody could come and say that we don't need families. And, you know, sometimes in fiction you see that as well, that they try to portray a state that is, you know, taking care of the children and trying to get away from, you know, the idea of the family. So I think one reason for that is what we mentioned before, is that it's a remnant of the divine religions, right? Mm-hmm. That because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brought it, as Brother Muhammad said, in the religion itself, mm-hmm. All the religions, Islam with, you know, that's brought by all the prophets. And in the West, we see that there's remnants of that Christianity left, right? So they still value family, because one reason is because of that. Another reason is for, you know, pragmatic reasons, right? A society where the family unit is not strong, even a non-religious person could see that, okay, that society is not going to function very well. Mm-hmm. Most of the criminals, you know, a lot of the criminals, they are those who have had dysfunctional families. They had problems in their families, and they ended up becoming the way that they you know, they came out to be. So basically, every society understands and recognizes the need for family. Mm-hmm. Now, in the West, because of the ideas of liberalism, that is